May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Rosen, attorney registration 23372, and I'm not nearly as tall as the last gentleman who was up.
I was a bit intimidated by that myself.
Let's get that back down there where I can use that a little bit. I'd like to start attorney registration 23372, appearing on behalf of and with Mr. Miguel Pena Rodriguez, defendant appellate in the case. I'd like to start with what I think is the most obvious error in the case. And it's most obvious because I think the law is most clear. And that is the court's limitation on defense counsel's ability to contact jurors post-trial. The court thought that the law said you must comply with Rule 33 and you must provide affidavits of the who, what, where, why, and when of misconduct before you can get in touch with any of the jurors and talk to them. That's flat out wrong. That's not the law in the state of Colorado. And I know this because, A, that's what the jurors are instructed after every single criminal case in the state of Colorado. It's what this jury was instructed after this case by this judge, and the Stewart v. Rice decision of the Colorado Supreme Court says that that is wrong.
Mr. Rosen, just to clarify, were you trying to get from the court the addresses of all of the jurors, their names and addresses?
I was not defense counsel.
But was the trial counsel trying to?
The trial counsel, addresses, phone numbers, ability to contact them. Because the law says, as trial counsel, if I want to get in touch with a juror and find out whether or not the color of my tie was distracting to them, I'm entitled to do that.
And trial counsel hadn't tried to speak to the jurors immediately after trial?
Did. And that is why there was some initial information that was given to trial counsel. But that is not the limits of the law. There's nothing to...
I'm sorry. Can you point me to a specific case or statute that grants the right you're advancing?
Stewart v. Rice.
No, Stewart v. Rice doesn't say counsel has a constitutional or statutory right to access juror contact information. It says counsel may contact jurors. Those are different questions.
How can you contact jurors without contact information?
Well, you can do what happened here. You can talk to them after court. They may or may not choose to contact you. They may or may not choose to give you their contact information so that you can follow that up. But I don't mean to argue with you. Please come back and give me a specific case or statute that says trial counsel in a criminal case has a right to juror contact information.
I don't think there's a case out there that says that. There's no law out there that says that.
Well, there are many federal, because it's a practice in many federal courts that you can't do that, and there are federal circuit cases that say that does not impinge on a defendant's constitutional right.
And that's right. And Stewart v. Rice looked at the federal laws.
Okay.
And looked at those provisions and said that is not the law in the state of Colorado.
The
Stewart court expressly looked at the federal law and said, no, Colorado doesn't follow that.
Okay, I apologize. So you're reading Stewart as creating what, a sort of a common law right to contact jurors?
But saying there's nothing in the law that prohibits
that. That's the difference. I'm trying to eliminate my question. There's a difference between saying the law doesn't prohibit you from contacting jurors and saying the law requires the court to give you the tools to do so.
I would respectfully disagree.
Okay, enough said.
That's okay. And just to follow up on that, the law doesn't give you the ability to do something and withhold the information that allows you to do that. That's illogical. And the law doesn't do that. And there's no law that says a defendant, a counsel, should not get that information. And because Stewart v. Rice said you can contact them, and there's no law that says the court has the ability to withhold that information, I disagree, respectfully.
Enough.
The more significant issue, I'm sorry to get sidetracked.
Largely my fault, so please go ahead.
The more significant issue, I think, in this case, is I really think the state of Colorado stands at the crossroads on a very important legal question. And that is, when one juror says to another juror something that is prejudice, something that is racist, something that is anti-Semitic, something that is offensive to our concepts of justice, can the trial court do anything about that? And in this case, the trial court said no. Rule 606B prohibits me from inquiring into this. And I think that's wrong. And although we don't have Colorado law on this, there is a lot of authority from other jurisdictions on this, and they have approached it in different ways. So it's not clear. And I think this court is posed at a crossroads, poised at a crossroads. I mean, really, seriously, and a very important one. The statements that were contained in the affidavits from the jurors, it's abhorrent to me, as a lawyer licensed to practice in this state, that that could go on in one of our jury rooms. That is abhorrent.
But let's assume, and please, I'm not trying to get you to concede any points that you might wish to argue. Let's assume we conclude the lower court was correct when it held that Juror 11 hadn't been questioned in sufficient detail about racial or ethnic biases. Why shouldn't that finding, if we uphold it, foreclose any further inquiry into whether 606B is unconstitutional as applied?
Because the law is concerned with whether or not a defendant has a right to a fair trial. And even if it's not disclosed during voir dire, if it is discovered later, let's say, for example, let me posit this back to you. If the juror had, after the trial, called up the prosecutor and told the prosecutor these things, and it wasn't inside the jury room, right? So there's no 606B issue. The law would still be concerned with whether or not the defendant received a fair trial, right?
I'm not sure that's true. If let's say Ms. Juror 11 calls up either counsel after the trial and says, "I'd just like you to know, I'm a lifetime member of the Ku Klux Klan," you'd still have to get into the question of whether that permeated deliberations. No.
No, I don't believe you do, and that's based on Morrison. I respectfully disagree with your analysis on that. Morrison says what counts is whether or not there is a biased juror on the jury panel, period, right? And even if a challenge for cause is wrongfully denied, if it is discussed and it's wrongfully denied, we don't get into the question of did the prejudice affect the deliberations. Morrison tells us that. That is not the issue for the court.
Mr. Rosen, in light of that, I could you clarify, because I'm not clear from your briefs whether you're asking for just an outright reversal or for a remand to the trial court for further hearing, because I think you may have said both.
And I did say both. And I said it for different issues for different reasons. I'm faced with the problem of the trial court limiting the information that was presented down at the trial court level. So we have limitations. The state wasn't given an opportunity to present counter affidavits or present live testimony of the jurors as to whether or not there was prejudice or not. And I understand that. And this normally being a question of fact, I would assume, or at least something that a court would need to decide at a lower level subject to appeal, I think remand is probably most likely to occur for that decision to be made. If this court feels that the evidence is admissible and is substantial enough just based on the affidavits, I would welcome a reversal. Mr. Pena Rodriguez would welcome that.
But let me ask you one follow-up related question. You said in your reply brief that by the time an opinion is issued, Mr. Pena Rodriguez will have served his sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What impact, if any, would that have on our writing an opinion?
I don't think it has any impact on the writing of your opinion. It has everything to do with Mr. Pena Rodriguez. That most of the time people come before the court because they're in prison and they feel wronged on criminal cases and they're languishing and they want to get out. This case is a matter of principle. This case is a matter of what the law in the state of Colorado should be. And when there is a prejudiced juror and a person is convicted because of that, that is just so fundamentally wrong that it can't exist in our state.
Let me return to my question. I'll give
yes,
you-
sir.
We've got statutes that impose disqualifications for people who are law enforcement employees and various iterations of that. Let's assume that counsel was totally inept and did not ask any juror any question about whether they were an employee of a law enforcement agency, which I think is a statutory term. Trial goes ahead, deliberations are done, defendant's convicted, and then after that it surfaces that one of the jurors clearly fell within that prohibition. Would the defendant have a remedy, or would he be barred by his counsel's failure to ask the proper question at voir dire?
I would certainly hope he would have a remedy, and that's based on the fact that not only does defense counsel have an obligation to ensure a fair trial, the prosecutor has an obligation to ensure a fair trial. The trial court judge has an obligation, does this court.
Let me make my question a little more focused. Can you point to me any case in Colorado in which a question that would have led to a statutory disqualification could have been asked, wasn't asked, and the defendant successfully argued the disqualification after the jury was sworn?
Off the top of my head, no, I cannot.
I mean, there are cases going the other way, are there not?
I believe there are.
Why shouldn't we apply those cases here?
Because racial prejudice, anti-Semitism, ethnic prejudice is fundamentally different.
Worse than being an employee of a law enforcement agency in terms of bias against a criminal defendant?
If you want my humble opinion, yes.
Okay.
It destroys the fundamental fabric of the right to a fair trial. It destroys everything. Due process, equal protection, the right to demand the charges get proved beyond a reasonable doubt, a verdict by stereotype is something that should never be condoned.
Mr. Rosen, here during voir dire, there apparently were no questions asked by the trial defense counsel or by the prosecutor, for that matter, about whether there was any prejudice against the defendant or his witness because of his ethnic background. Did the trial defense counsel have any kind of obligation to ask whether the prospective jurors were prejudiced on that ground or on the basis that the witness might have been an undocumented alien, or is that something of trial strategy?
It could be strategy, or it could be negligence. It could just be ineffective assistance of counsel. At direct appeal, I don't get the option of exploring that. That is a 35C later. That will, if this conviction stands, will certainly occur as to what defense counsel was thinking and why he didn't. That being said, I would respectfully disagree with the trial court's analysis, A, that a specific question must be asked, and B, that it wasn't asked. Okay. The question was, are you fair? And we know he was not fair. Okay. He may not have understood that because he may have thought that he was fair. The trial court may be right about that, but that doesn't mean he disclosed. That means it was an inadvertent disclosure. He didn't understand the question. That's okay. We get that, and the law gets that. And when it's inadvertent, you look to see if there's bias. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we're not punishing the juror. What we're doing is protecting the defendant's right to a fair trial.
So taking that argument and getting back to one of the questions that Judge Taubman asked,
yes, sir.
I'm trying to get in my own mind, if there were a remand,
yes, sir.
What would that remand look like? What are the issues that would be litigated to get from point A to point B?
Fair enough. Assuming this court remands and allows a full investigation with juror contact information, it would be any and all issues uncovered by that information where there's a factual basis to proceed on them. We don't know yet because we haven't done an investigation yet. We were curtailed to the very bare minimum. The defense counsel was told you can only contact these two jurors, you can only ask them these questions, you can only explore this one issue, whether or not non-disclosure was inadvertent or not inadvertent. And that was it. There may be 87 other grounds for misconduct that haven't been explored yet. We don't know.
But I assume at a minimum you're saying that there would need to be an evidentiary hearing, presumably at which juror 11 would have an opportunity to testify, or the jurors that submitted affidavits would testify.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I think that would be appropriate, if it's possible. The jurors may be dead at this point, or they may not remember anything. They may be gone. There may be prejudice which prohibits these things. That would be an issue for the trial court to deal with. And if that's the case, then we'll make arguments down there and we'll deal with it down there. But assuming that we can find the jurors at this late point in time, and we can talk to them and they can give us information that's valuable, I would want the opportunity to explore any possible grounds. Certainly the bias. Certainly I don't think 606B prohibits that. I don't think it can. I don't think it should. I've reserved the last 28 seconds of my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Majid Yazdi. Registration 36043, representing the people in this case. On the question of the access, the right to access to the jurors, I think Mr. Rosen is misreading Stewart. Stewart is very clear in terms of the ability of the defendant or the prosecution to contact jurors, but does not make that a right. And on page 325, I'm going to read it, before stating that law, the court contrasts other jurisdictions, First Circuit, Second Circuit, and the Federal District Court of Colorado, in which the courts actually prohibit access unless there's a specific authorization by the court. Defense counsel or prosecution cannot contact jurors. In contrast to those, here the Supreme Court in Stewart says, in contrast, Colorado's standard post-verdict jury instruction allows attorneys, parties, and investigators to speak with willing jurors. Allowing it is different from being required to provide access and facilitating when the jurors may not be willing to talk about the cases. In this case, for example, there were two jurors who willingly talked to defense counsel and provided the information that was used to get the in the affidavits and to ask the court to continue in the investigation.
Mr. Yossi, is it your view then that when a trial is concluded, a defense attorney will have an opportunity to speak with all 12 jurors before they leave the courtroom?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Is it your view that after a criminal trial is over, that a defense attorney will have an opportunity to speak with all 12 jurors?
In terms of having the legal right to do that or opportunity?
Well, no, I understand your position is that they have the legal right to at that point, but just as a practical matter, I would think that after a trial is over, the jurors would be intent on going home. And then if you started speaking to juror one and juror one said, yes, I'd like to talk to you and tell you, here are my thoughts, and then maybe the defense attorney would talk to juror two. In the meantime, several other jurors may have left. Is that a reasonable scenario?
I think in terms of practicality, if Your Honor is pointing out how practical it is to talk to every single juror, I think it may pose some issues, and there are ways to get around that. For example, the defense counsel might say that we would like to talk to every one of you who is willing. If you can't stay, if you can provide your information so we can contact you later, that can certainly be done. So there is certainly the opportunity, both in terms of practicality and in terms of the legal rights to do that. And again, it was done here, and the information was provided. The thing, Mr. Rosen's position leads, and it was clear from the comments both in the opening brief and here, Mr. Rosen wants an unrestricted, unfettered access for a fishing expedition. And it is clear that it says there are still claims that we don't know that might exist out there. We want to explore that. This is exactly what 606B prohibits. Stewart is also clear on that point. And I think this court is bound by the holding that 606B must be applied based on the plain language and limited to the two exceptions that are recognized.
I don't understand how 606B would prohibit a defense attorney from speaking with jurors, because as I understand it, the rule only prohibits contact if it's annoying or bothersome to the jurors.
In Stewart, actually, the court indirectly, when criticizing the procedure that was adopted there or the behavior of counsel, the court said that even the investigation that was done here, it was inconsistent with 606B's spirit and fundamental principles.
How is that so?
Because the prohibition is that if the information is not extraneous or improper, outside information, then there is no reason to even investigate.
Oh, but other courts, as you know, Mr. Yazdi, have said that it's appropriate for counsel to contact or speak to the jurors if for no other reason than to find out what the jurors found persuasive or unpersuasive in the case. If they didn't like the fact that a defense attorney was wearing a yellow tie, they could say that, and that wouldn't be run afoul of Rule 606B, as I understand it. Would you agree?
Well, if it's, again, the definition is that extraneous information or outside influence.
That's for challenging. That's the standard for challenging a jury verdict. I'm talking not about challenging a jury verdict, but about just speaking to jurors. Those are different issues.
The purpose of the investigation is what I think and Stewart was questioned. That the question, the investigation itself, and if I can quickly on page 327, the court says the defense inquiry contravened the language and purposes of CRE 606B. There's a clear hint here that although the procedure is available to the counsel to investigate, but there is the overall restriction that is a broad restriction imposed by 606B that should guide that investigation. And that is the point that I'm asking the court to take into consideration. On the question of the procedure that was adopted here, the record is clear that the trial court was very careful in terms of how to allow, perhaps even more than what 606B would allow, how to allow the investigation to proceed without violating the spirit of 606B, without violating the privacy of the jurors. Asking defense counsel to identify who the two jurors were in terms of gender, so to narrow down the investigation to female or male based on that information, and then further asking what the specific information was and whether that would be usable or not. So the court provided enough opportunity for defense counsel to investigate. What Judge Webb asked, what would happen on remand? What defense counsel, what defendant is asking right now is to conduct additional investigation. What would be the point of that? We know that two jurors have provided affidavits that there were some racially biased comments made. What is the point of contacting other jurors? We already have that information. And that was the only basis for filing the motion for additional investigation and for new trial. That information, as the court properly concluded, cannot be used to impeach the verdict. We know that. That's under 606B.
Why is that? Take me through that argument.
Because it is part of the deliberative process. And that is where Mr. Rosen is right, that there are courts that may take that as an exception, but most federal courts, as is stated in the answer brief, in case of Viller, cites the cases, most federal courts have concluded that racial bias is not within the exception of the two limited exceptions of 606B. That is why.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
That is why using that information to impeach the verdict would be prohibited under 606B.
Is there any Colorado case that says that, one way or the other?
Not specifically on the racial issue, Your Honor. But again, my point and my argument is that when you read Stewart, Stewart is very clear that first of all, 606B is a very broad prohibition, is an exclusionary rule, and the two exceptions that are applicable here are very limited and narrow.
Mr. Yazdi, as you know, in the Viller case or the VR case, the First Circuit held that even though asking questions about racially biased statements did not come within the exceptions to 606B, that nevertheless it was appropriate for trial courts to inquire about such statements. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And it cited various other courts that have held along the same lines. Isn't that correct as well?
Yes. Well, in terms of inquiry, conducting an inquiry, the inquiry was done actually here in this case, and that is why I suggested that the court was careful about adopting a procedure that would be, in the court's opinion, consistent with 606B. But based on the information that was provided, it did not lead to further investigation or did not require further investigation because the affidavits suggested that there was racial remarks made, but the court could not. Definitely, this is the part that I don't think Villar would, be inconsistent with that. The court could not focus on that and decide whether to any extent those racial remarks influenced the deliberations.
So is your position, Mr. Yazdi, that if after a trial a juror reports that another juror made a statement, no matter how racially prejudicial or biased it might be, that 606B precludes a trial court from taking any action with regard to that that juror?
Again, Your Honor, most federal courts have adopted that position.
I'm asking, is that your position?
I think based on Colorado cases and my reading of Stewart, which this court should abide by, I think it prohibits doing any investigation based on that and trying to impeach the verdict. Unless the Supreme Court of the Colorado has not adopted that position.
What if the investigation showed that not just one, but seven of the jurors espoused racial or anti-Semitic comments? Does that change your view at all? And if so, what principled basis is there for changing your view on that? Or is it still the same? Doesn't matter if it's one juror or all 12 of them. 606B says you can't get into that.
It is obviously a very difficult scenario that Your Honor is presenting, but based on 606B and the two narrow exceptions that have been identified and the way they have been interpreted in Colorado, I would suggest that is still prohibited because that would not fall. However, it doesn't mean that there is, in terms of criminal procedure, that the defendant is not protected, because the protection comes from voir dire. If that procedure is done properly, then we would not get to the kind of scenario that Your Honor is presenting. And of course, to answer another question, if it happens that the counsel failed to do a thorough and complete voir dire, then the defendant has ineffective assistance of counsel in a post-conviction motion to pursue that.
Mr. Yazdi, how can we be sure that a more thorough voir dire would have brought forth an admission of racial bias, especially given the discussion in the VR case of reference to United States Supreme Court decisions that potential jurors are not likely to say, yes, I am biased, if asked that during voir dire?
I think the trial court was aware of that issue and pointed out that because of the nature of prejudice, which is kind of a soft area to explore and requires more specific questioning, as the trial court pointed out, in many cases when the defendant is African American, there are questions specifically addressed to suspected jurors, whether there is any potential bias, and then exploring that. I think that is what is needed given the nature of the bias that may not be something that comes out openly, or the person may volunteer because they may not be fully aware even of those layered of biases. It is the job of defense counsel or the prosecutor to bring out those maybe hidden layers and ask very specific questions. There was no question asked in this case, and the court was very clear about that. That could have helped the court and the parties to identify if there was any basis for racial bias.
Well, you say that it's the job of defense counsel and the prosecutor. They've got different jobs. So if the prosecutor, I mean, there's no ineffective assistance of counsel claim against the prosecutor. What's the defendant supposed to do about that? And what's the role of the court? Regardless of what counsel does, should the court be asking these questions?
The role of the court, Your Honor, is to ask the more general questions that address the more obvious cases of, not someone who obviously knows that he's not going to be fair because he's against, for example, the prosecution for whatever reason. Those questions that are asked by the court address, the kind of bias that can be easily identified. But other than that, I think it falls on the shoulders of defense counsel to make sure that the jury is fair and impartial as far as racial biases are concerned.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosen, now 26 seconds.
So be as brief as I can.
I promise not to interrupt you.
It's quite all right.
The deliberative process is about jurors listening to evidence and finding facts and applying those facts to the law that is given to them by the judge. It is not about looking at somebody and saying, you're one of those people. Those people steal, so you're guilty. That is not the deliberative process, and it shouldn't be. And I apologize for the tenor of my tone. The tone before, this is personal to me, and I apologize, it shouldn't be. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. Case will stand submitted. Division will issue an opinion in due course.